All right, it's Fan Pregame on a Friday. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff pregaming two elimination game fours, both on Sportsnet. Tonight, Boston looks to close out Dallas, win its 18th NBA title in a sweep over the Mavericks. We'll have Arash Madani live from the floor in Dallas in about a half hour. Then tomorrow night, game four of the Stanley Cup Final. Stanley and Shania in the building. I guess Shania will probably be in the building.
Yeah.
Florida can sweep away the Oilers in Edmonton. We'll have Luke Gaznik in a moment to talk about that one. And the Blue Jays also kick off a weekend series with the Cleveland Guardians on Sportsnet 1 tonight. Okay, Jesse, Oilers mount a comeback, but lose 4-3, down 3-0.
Mm-hmm.
Hope seems lost for an all-time Stanley Cup final. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's only been done four times, and it game one was really the opportunity. I think the Oilers had to plant a seed of doubt in the Florida Panthers' minds. Hey, this team deserves to be reckoned with. And unfortunately, they played really well, but they couldn't solve Sergei Bobrovsky. And really, from that moment onwards, the Florida Panthers said, look, we're the better team, and we're going to make you aware of the fact that we are the better team right from puck drop. And I was honestly a little bit surprised that, you know, given the atmosphere and the environment in the building last night and outside the building, frankly, in Edmonton, first Stanley Cup final game since 2006, I was expecting a massive push from the Oilers, and it just didn't really come until the second period when they started to play a little bit better. And I think probably the Panthers were expecting more of a push from the Oilers that never really came. And ultimately, I talked about yesterday how the Panthers are just relentless. And again, yesterday, the goals, you just see the forechecks out of control. Like the Sam Bennett play where he's heavy on the forecheck and then Tkachuk gets it back to him. They force the turnover from Darnell Nurse. I mean, that's what this team does. And over the course of 60 minutes, over the course of a seven-game series, that's really difficult to beat. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing exactly why the Edmonton Oilers are having so much trouble in this series.
Yeah, it is frustrating, too, because it did feel like it could be all-time. It felt like it could have been something really, truly special in terms of a matchup with, yeah, the best team. Like a team that really, really frustrates opponents and would be like the highest level of competition that a great player or a great duo like the Edmonton Oilers have would try to get through. And we'd see the push and pull. We'd see the Oilers get a couple, Florida do their thing, and it would go back and forth. And yet, yeah, we're three games in and it's 3-0 Florida, and it seems like all hope is lost. But you mentioned that, like, the little mistakes that cost the Oilers, little mistakes, turning into big moments and goals. It's funny how it's like, yeah, you preach that stuff all the time if you're a coach, really in any sport. Like, if we do these right things, we'll be rewarded. It seems every time the mistake is prompted, they're able to create those mistakes, they're able to capitalize.
For sure.
Uncanny how it's almost like coach speak playing out in real time, and that kind of makes sense because Paul Maurice is at the top of the game, right? And it seems if any coach is going to be rewarded for those things, for getting a team to buy into something so specific and so routine, at least for them, that they would be rewarded that way. It feels like it's right in the moment, and yet when it's 3-0 and we don't really have a Stanley Cup final anymore, at least it seems, kind of feels wrong.
Yeah, the Florida Panthers had 54 seconds of offensive zone time when they scored those three goals in 6 minutes and 19 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
That is just absurd. But it proves to you that the Edmonton Oilers last night specifically, it was a compounding of mistakes. Skinner coming out of his net, not getting to the puck, not being able to settle it down, and then CeCe getting beat to the puck. That's two mistakes in one play. And then the other goal that I referenced before with Bennett going into the corner, I mean, defenseman doesn't handle it well. And then Tkachuk and Bennett able to force the turnover from Darnell Nurse. That's two mistakes again on one goal. And that's what the Panthers do. They're opportunistic because even last night, the offensive zone time wasn't crazy, but the chances that they had, they were able to take advantage of. And that's something that they've been doing all season long. And it certainly felt to me last night that this was a team that has been here before. They know exactly what they have to do. They just have this feel of like hired assassins that are just going in there, knowing exactly what the job is. Get in, get out, see you later. Quick work of the Oilers, and that's that. They seem truly like the best team in the National Hockey League. I think at the end of the season, a long 82-game grueling schedule and then four rounds of a playoff, I think what you want at the end is the best team to win. And through at least three games of this cup final and everything we've seen so far in this playoff. It really does feel like the Florida Panthers are the best team in the National Hockey League.
It does feel, I think you make a great point there, like they have the answers to the test.
To everything, right? Yeah.
So they have the answers. They go out and just write the test, and it feels like that's what they've been doing over and over and over again. And you can't simplify it that much. Of course, it's required some great performance out of Sergei Bobrovsky. It's required some luck, right? Posts were hit in the games in Florida, and of course, game one went the way of the Oilers, at least in terms of the run of play. But when you have the answers to the test, you feel comfortable going in to any test, right? An examination, whatever. You're in high school, you're in university. If you know the answers, if you're ready, you're going to feel comfortable because you can get through it. And it feels like Florida knows exactly what to do, and they're just executing on a level higher than the Edmonton Oilers right now. Let's bring in someone who used to play for the Edmonton Oilers, is in Edmonton now, covering the series for Sportsnet Central with Ken Reed and Ivanka Osmak, our guy Luke Gazdick. What's going on, Luke?
Not much, boys. What's happening?
We're coping a little bit. It's not like we're like upset, but we thought there was the potential for something truly great here. Like it could have been, you know, best team versus best player, best players, if you want to extend that to Leon Draisaitl, and it just hasn't worked out that way. I guess you got to go to the Oilers for this conversation or for this point. Why hasn't it worked out? Like, what is stopping the Oilers from asserting themselves in the series? Why hasn't it worked for Edmonton, Luke?
Well, it's a great question. And I got to watch my first game live yesterday. So we watched the first two periods at the rink, where I'm usually watching it on screens for this series. And I mean, the easiest answer and the one that you're going to hear the most is Sergei Bobrovsky. And I understand that's an easy one to say, and one guy doesn't make a hockey team, but my goodness, is he just so poised and so confident. His pushes from east to west are so strong. You can tell that's one goal of the Oilers, was to try to get him moving east-west and side to side. And he's covering so much ground. There was one save he made where he's like stand-up style, 5 feet outside of the crease, like the old school goalies did. He just looks really confident right now. And this is just an opportunistic Florida team. Like Nuge talked about it in his presser this morning in his media avail about how with the little mistakes that they make, Florida just makes them pay every time. And yeah, you can look, I think I caught the tail end of you guys before. You can look at, you know, the CC Skinner kind of mix up behind the net, the Nurse turnover. They make you pay every time. Mm-hmm. And they force those turnovers too. Like these forecheckers are just absolutely hounding the puck and have a tendency to get it back. They're making them make plays and making them make decisions. And you know what? Another big one, I think the international stage is now seeing how good Alexander Barkov is. Like, once again, one player does not make a hockey team, but you can just see how dialed in he is and how much he leads the team. He kills penalties. He plays power play. He takes every single big draw in the D zone. And the amount of times I was sitting above the goaltender, pretty high up, but the amount of times we'd see him win a D-zone draw and then end up with an offensive zone chance and an offensive zone faceoff was just time after time. And he's really got them going. They're just built different, put it that way.
Who would your Conn Smythe pick be between? You just mentioned the two of them. I mean, there's really no debate, I think, at this point that Barkov has been able to shut down every important player that he's gone against. And Sergei Bobrovsky, I mean, you saw it again last night, that save he made with just over 4 minutes to go in the third when the Oilers were mounting that comeback. Like, that, to me, felt like the defining moment of the series. So if you had to pick between the two of them, they're both exceptional hockey players and have been great. Which one would you choose?
I mean, there's no wrong answer. I think you're right. To me, it's Bobrovsky. I don't think they're in the position they are without the way he's played. It's one of the best goaltending performances I've ever seen in a playoff run like this. And like I said, it's just time after time, and it's not just big saves, it's timely saves as well, right? Like the two breakaways in game one, whatever it was, and even last night, power plays, they're trying their backdoor plays, and it's even the great A's they have, he's just been there every step of the way for them. And I don't think their success is without him.
So we just talked about how great Bobrovsky's been and how amazing Barkov has been at shutting down the top guns for every team. But the fact remains that Draisaitl, Hyman, Nuge, they don't have a point in the series. McDavid doesn't have a goal in the series. Despite Bob being as good as he is and Barkov being as good as he is, how surprised are you by the lack of production from the guys that have been the straw that has stirred the drink for the Oilers all season long.
You know what? I am. They, what do they have? Four goals, and it's McLeod, Fogle, Broberg, and Ekholm. I mean, I just didn't expect it at this time. You can tell. I don't want to say they're running out of gas, but they had a challenging three rounds, and I mean, that's no excuse. Their power play has gone over. I think that's the thing that I'm most surprised at. That's where they are going to get a majority of their goals and points, and Florida's PK has just been outstanding. Like, we've talked about Bob six times, but it's the PK and the work they've done killing penalties and pre-scouting and not giving them anything. They give you nothing for free. It's just the way they've played top to bottom has made it really challenging on them. And I will say I'm surprised, but the top guys got to be better. And they know that, right? Like, you can tell in their post-game pressers last night with Connor and Leon, they both, you can sense there's a little frustration, and Leon takes a lot of pride in that, in leading the team and being one of those guys that comes up in clutch moments and with clutch plays and big goals. And when they showed the board yesterday, it's just goose eggs all down the right side of the column. I mean, you're just not going to win when the other team's top players are playing better than yours.
Yeah. Chris Knobloch has reached deep into his coaching bag during these playoffs and pulled out a few winners with lineup decisions. I'm surprised at this point that, you know, there hasn't been more of a shakeup in the top six, and I guess specifically targeting that first line, because you guys mentioned, you know, Draisaitl, Nuge, Hyman. Like, I don't think Nugent Hopkins and Hyman have played well at all, and I feel like, yeah, just maybe another look up top might just change the dynamic or maybe get someone or something going. If you had a moment with Chris Knobloch, is there any lineup advice you would give him based on what we've seen and what might need to happen?
Advice. You know what? I thought about it leading into game three, and the one I thought about was going back to Henrique on the left side and sliding Nuge down with Draisaitl and then putting whoever on their right side, whether it's Holloway, whether it's Perry. They're a little hampered right now because I think they're trying to figure out Evander Kane and what level they can get him at. He has been a dominant player for them in past playoffs, but obviously he's not 100% or even close to it. I do definitely think they need some sort of shakeup. And even just for the purity of sparking the guys a little bit, maybe just playing with different guys. And the biggest one for me that I think I would do is probably move Nuge back down with Leon. And so you can kind of have two big lines to go at any lines they throw out at you.
So it's obviously dire for the Edmonton Oilers at this point, being down 3-0. But this is a team that won 16 games in a row at one point in January. Stringing four together against the Florida Panthers is probably a bit of a different animal. But if you're the Oilers and you're going into game four, like, what has happened in this series that gives you reason to say, hey, we can actually, you know, get one and then something can happen? Because when I look at what happened in game one, it was a massive missed opportunity for the Oilers. But you look back to that game, and I don't want to say they dominated. I won't go as far as that, but they played really, really well, and Bobrovsky was the story. So if you're in the room, where are you looking for motivation that, hey, maybe this is something that actually can be done?
So two things I took out of what you asked me. Knobloch said this morning, the last time we lost three games in a row, it ended up pretty good for us. He's obviously thinking glass half full. And you mentioned it's the room for me. Like, I know the room they have and the leadership they have there. And that's what makes me believe, is that they have the guys in place to do it. You saw all the zeros beside those top guys' names. They haven't even started to perform. The power play hasn't scored yet. Get a couple of those clicking. I think they finally figured it out towards the end of the period, scoring two goals, simplifying the game of hockey, where it's throw pucks to the net with traffic and drivers. Like, that is the number one scouting report on any single goaltender or team in the league. So I think simplify the game. But the belief that I would have, if you're an Oilers fan or you want to look for a way they can claw back into it, is their mindset is they don't have to win four games. They have to win one game, and that's tomorrow night. And I think that's where they start. They look at their leaders from Connor all the way down, and they look for them to lead the way, and the depth will follow. And honestly, it's easy to play in front of an atmosphere like that on Thursday night. I was in the building, and my goodness, I had shivers when they came out, 17,000 strong, and then tens of thousands out in the street. I'm sure they're picking up some energy from that, but they got to use that. They got to get a goal, whether it's scoring first or even just getting a big goal early in the first period to get that crowd really on your side. That's something that's going to be a talking point for sure in their mindset going into it.
Luke, if the Oilers fall short of what would be a miraculous comeback and lose the Stanley Cup final, do you worry at all for the future of this team and the idea that McDavid and Draisaitl can get back and get over the hump, that McDavid, who was supposed to win one of these, is going to win one of these? It's not like, you know, it's not salary cap hell coming, but Draisaitl has an uncertain future, of course, and there's going to be a lot of change because there's always change to good rosters across the NHL, and of course, McDavid's got to sign a new deal soon as well. Is there concern about the length of the window and getting back? Because we know, despite Florida doing it just now and maybe coming through here with a Stanley Cup, it is really, really hard to get back the next year. It's really hard to get back at all. Is there concern for you there?
Well, I might be the wrong guy to ask because I seriously look at everything in like the positive light and the glass half full. And I don't think these guys are going anywhere. I think they stay here and I think they win here. I see a lot of parallels from last year with Florida. When Florida got to the Cup Finals versus Vegas, they were out of gas and they were banged up. Like almost all their top guys were nursing some sort of massive major injury. And they ran into a Vegas team that was veteran, that played a very simple, tough, hard brand of playoff hockey. And I think they learned a lot from that. And they came back in from day one of preseason with the goal of getting back to where they were. And here they are on the verge of winning a cup. And I think Edmonton's learning a lot from this right now. They're learning. I think they thought they knew before this how hard it was to Stanley Cup. I don't know how hard it is to win. I've never been in this position, but I think they are realizing now how tough it is to win. And this is just a great learning lesson, no matter what happens with this Oilers team. And I think they're picking up a lot from the Panthers and the path that they went. This is a team that they can learn a lot from. And I think Leon and Connor are seeing this in real time right now. But I've always been of the mindset that they stay here and they win here because I just see it as unfinished business, and getting this close will leave that taste in their mouth. Mm-hmm. And I do think they will be back here no matter what happens in the rest of this series.
If you're a head coach or a general manager of the 30 other teams that are watching this series and you're seeing how dominating the Florida Panthers have been, what is it from a either tactical standpoint or a roster construction standpoint that you look at the Florida Panthers and you say, hey, that's something that we can actually apply to our game? Because for me, it's the relentlessness of their forecheck and the way that they just come at you in waves. And obviously the personnel matters a lot for that, but also the job that Paul Maurice and his coaching staff have been able to do matters as well. So when you watch the Florida Panthers, what do you think is something that other teams can take away and apply to the way that they play?
Well, I go back to Paul Maurice's press conference after game two, and he mentioned about them playing a brand of playoff hockey from day one, from game one of the preseason, starting in game one of the regular season. You don't wait till the playoffs to play playoff hockey. Right. You play that brand of hockey all year round. And he goes, it's hard. Like, it's really hard to play that way for 82 games. But the guys that do and the guys that want to stick around and play that way, you're going to have some success. And it takes a lot of buy-in from your guys because it just goes up and down. Like, every day in the NHL, it's an absolute grind. And to be able to play that fast, that hard, that aggressive, that physical for an entire year, stay healthy, and put yourself in this position is not an easy thing to do. But I think people are seeing that this is the brand of hockey that you need to play year-round. You can't just turn it on in the playoffs, or you can't just make the Stanley Cup Finals and go, okay, we're going to buy in and really lock it down now defensively. It has to be habits, and it really has to be second nature to you by the time you get there. So it's almost like you're on autopilot. It's almost as if this Panthers team doesn't have to be coached. Like, I get that Paul Maurice has done an incredible mm-hmm. job, but they're just like robots out there. Like, yeah. Their forecheck is like watching the same thing every time. They go to the same spots. If you turn over pucks with them, they're going to put it right in the back of your net. It's like watching the same story unfold play after play and game after game. So I think it's something that they made a mindset of was we're going to start this now in day one of training camp. We're not going to wait till the playoffs to turn it on. And I think a lot of teams, like I said, including the Oilers, can learn a lot from this Panthers team.
Yeah, I'm going to have nightmares of that five-man unit just working like a symphony, just moving together as one, synchronized swimming. Yeah, it's just, it's been a treat to watch. You got to be a little bit of a hockey sicko to consider it a treat, but it's been really, really impressive nonetheless. Luke Gazdick will be at Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Final covering for Sportsnet, Sportsnet Central. We appreciate you coming on, Luke. Enjoy game four, and yeah, we'll be watching you.
Awesome. Thank you as always, guys.
That's Luke Gazdick.
Thanks, Luke.
Hockey Night Canada and Sportsnet Central. Yeah, that Florida Panthers five-man unit, it moves in a way where not a hair is out of place, right? Mm. Like, and that is something that I don't think every team can do. Like, I don't think you want McDavid to be doing that. I don't think you necessarily want every single player to be like everybody else, robotic in the way that they do things. But that's the way this team's been built. And if they stepped outside of that, it wouldn't work the same way.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. Like, the Oilers, you can make the argument, well, I think it's pretty clear. They have the game-breaking offensive talent. It's not to take anything away from Barkov or Tkachuk or Reinhardt, but when they play, those guys just kind of fit into everything else. Like, they're all an ingredient in this recipe. And sometimes with the Oilers, whether it's McDavid trying to press or Leon trying to press, like, you get the feeling that the weight of the world is on those guys' shoulders to try and carry their team. Whether, you know, McDavid, there's been times in the series where he's tried to go one on four and it hasn't worked out for him. And the Florida Panthers just don't do that. They are all a key in the cog of what is the Florida Panthers. And that has been the secret to their success.
Indeed, it has. Fresh off an off day, the Toronto Blue Jays open a weekend set with the Cleveland Guardians. It's going to be a tough weekend, perhaps, for the Blue Jays' anemic offense. They will see two of the worst pitchers for Cleveland, Logan Allen and Carlos Carrasco. They will avoid Tanner Bibee, Cleveland's best pitcher this season. But the bullpen for Cleveland is otherworldly. They are the best in baseball by far, accumulated 4.5 wins, according to Fangraphs WAR. They got a 2.33 ERA, only one other team in the twos, the Blue Jays third last at 4.88. So if you're looking at some tight games after five innings, maybe you know where the advantage will lie. But an interesting move today, Daniel Vogelbach DFA'd, Addison Barger brought up. Also adjacent to that, Jose Abreu DFA'd by the Houston Astros. Can I interest you in a Jose Abreu?
No. I mean, you could make the argument that from an offensive standpoint with the Blue Jays, it cannot get much worse. So why not? And there's a reason that Daniel Vogelbach was sent down. Mm-hmm. And that's why all the consternation about Kevin Biggio when he was sent down. I mean, it was kind of like, well, you're upset because you think Daniel Vogelbach took his spot. But the next domino to fall, if Vogelbach doesn't turn it around, is going to be Daniel Vogelbach. And that's what ended up happening. Abreu has had some great seasons, clearly 30 and 100.
MVP in 2021.
MVP.
Shortened season.
But man, has he fallen. And part of the issue for me is that the Blue Jays as a coaching staff haven't shown me that they have the ability to unlock something in a player who's been struggling. For example, Dave Roberts said when they acquired Kevin Biggio that the offensive guys in that organization saw something in Kevin that they think they'll be able to unlock. That doesn't happen in Toronto. The offense has struggled immensely to the point where they're just kind of bringing guys up from the Bison, seeing if they can make something stick. They're trying everything now, but the offense has been an issue for 2 years now. And bringing Jose Abreu in, a guy who has two home runs and seven RBI and is batting 195, isn't exactly something that I think would spark an anemic offense. But you can make a case just because of his track record that ultimately it can't get much worse. So why not?
Yeah, the why not is probably the best case. The other argument would be the OPS in the latter 3 months of the season for him, historically much better than the first three. So a slow starter. And even last season, OPS of 835 in the final month of the season was seven home runs. So maybe this is a guy who can get it going. But I think the best argument for it is I look at this team and the way that their starting pitching rotation has kept them in games consistently.
Again,
the bullpen's not great, but their pitching has been enough to, hey, if you're adding on a couple runs every night, the record looks decidedly different, right? So if they like, I'm for the fire sale because ultimately a World Series is all that matters. And I think you have to probably strip it down and start over if you're going to get there. But if we're talking about just trying to have some success this year, like one more competent bat, someone in the middle of the lineup that could theoretically change the way this offense operates and make everyone else a little bit better. I'm not saying that it would be Jose Abreu, but maybe a couple of years ago, I'd be foaming at the mouth trying to do this because, yeah, he's coming off really good seasons and historically has been a very, very productive hitter. Maybe he's not that guy now, but someone like that, like you could go either way with this if they start winning ball games. And then you're talking about, you know, maybe you can supplement the offense and suddenly this team changes. Like I'm on the fence with it, but it's the wins and losses matter the most here. But this team isn't that far away, which is what's so frustrating. And it's kind of dangling out there. Maybe Addison Barger could be that guy.
I just know that that is the exact conversation that's being had in the front office. And they're saying, look, we just pulled off all these renovations and we're only 3.5 back in the third wild card. It's I've said this multiple times now, but it is funny that the third wild card, it teases you. It gives you this little bit of hope that you can actually get into the dance and then anything can happen. But like the reality is, if you're looking at where they would be behind the Royals, they would be 6 games behind the Royals, who are the second wild card spot. Right. I can see a scenario where exactly what you just said plays out. The front office says, I'm only 3 games back of the third wild card. Our pitching is still pretty good.
And the trades aren't out there.
We go and get one bat. Maybe we could do it. Yeah. My question is, are fans kind of tired of that in the sense that you roll into the playoffs? You're not really, I mean, you're hoping, but you're not really expecting very much. They flame out again. And then you're right back where you started. They do have an opportunity, I think, at this deadline. There aren't going to be very many sellers because of what I just said. There's so many teams that are in the mix. I think you have an opportunity as the Blue Jays to really become the team that sells off at a premium because these are good players that you can sell off. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of free agents that are coming up that aren't going to have contracts. Yusei Kikuchi, Danny Jansen, those guys are premium players, would get you something in return.
Definitely.
So they could be sort of the hinge team at the deadline that says, yeah, we're close, but how close are we actually? Let's move some guys along and recoup some of that farm system that was left barren with Alex Anthopoulos and hasn't really gotten much better.
No, it hasn't. That third wild card makes teams make questionable decisions, right?
It throws a wrench in everything, honestly. There's so many teams. There's four teams ahead of the Blue Jays before you get to the third wild card.
It invites mediocrity, and that's exactly what's happening. And maybe maybe the Blue Jays can use that to their advantage if they do put their foot in the ground. The Boston Celtics can win the NBA title tonight.
Yeah, they can.
Arash Madani is there. We'll catch up with Arash after the break.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back on the Fan pregame. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff. After a half hour spent bemoaning what has been or what will be kind of a disappointing Stanley Cup final, let's turn our attention to maybe a disappointing NBA finals, at least in terms of competitiveness, with the Boston Celtics up 3-0 with the chance to close it out in Dallas tonight against the Mavericks. Arash Madani is covering the NBA finals in Sportsnet for Sportsnet. In Dallas, and he joins us now. What's going on, Arash?
I'm covering just for you. That's what I'm doing here, Justin.
Thank you, Arash. As I fumbled that, let's turn our attention to Luka Doncic fumbling a moment for him in his career. It's been a pretty rough look. I'm sure he appreciates the fact that there is not as much space between games 3 and 4 as there was 2 and 3 because everyone's...
Hold on. What's the rough look? You have a guy on one leg, on one ankle. He's got a chest contusion. He can barely practice. He's been carrying this entire team into the finals. I know we can't go 3 games in a series without injecting some kind of narrative into things, but I just do not understand this Luka thing. He's 25 years old. Other than Kyrie, with no supporting cast, against the best team in the league wire to wire this year that won 64 games. Like, what is the expectation?
I get. Oh, that's fair, though.
One Doncic.
If the defense, though, is age, then, you know, maturity level, he's not quite there yet, at least for this moment. I guess that's the point. Well, the Mavericks run a 22-2 run. He had more fouls than points, and his team finally gave him what he needed, and he fumbled that moment, at least in my opinion. And if we can't, we don't have to extrapolate it onto the entire stage and the entire series, but him in Game 3, with Dallas with a chance to get back into the series, did not perform at a level that would be considered championship quality, and therefore we have all these spawn think pieces. But for you, Doncic, okay, so there's reason to defend him, but do we have to see something different here in Game 4 from him specifically for this to all cool down? Like, can he call the dogs off to a certain extent with any type of performance? Because we know Boston's probably going to win this NBA Finals, but can Luka change the way people are talking about him still with what's left of this series?
Well, I think the talk is foolish, to be quite honest. And I think that there's not much of an understanding out there of just how historically great the Celtics team is. And maybe it's because they're not flashy, and maybe it's because they don't have the superstardom that the old Steph and Clay and KD group had. But just bear with me for a sec. They've now won 10 straight playoff games. The last time that happened was Steph, KD, and Clay in the 2017 Golden State team. No one's done it since. They've won 9 straight road playoff games. No one's done that since the Shaq and Kobe Lakers. From the beginning of the season, nobody has come close to being as good as Boston. They were the only team this year with 60-plus wins in the NBA. They have the best starting five in basketball, and it's not even close. Find me the hole and the area in the Celtics. And this is a juggernaut they're going up against, and it could be sustainable because Jaylen Brown's under contract long term. Jason Tatum's about to sign. They've locked up Drew Holiday. Like, they're here, and they're going to be a problem in the Eastern Conference for a while. Like, they swept Indiana in the conference finals. Like, this is a really good Boston team. So I don't know what Luka can do. Luka and Kyrie together haven't been able to do much. And if you really want to peel back a layer, the Dallas Mavericks bench has literally contributed nothing to this series. Like, Luka aside in Game 2, this was a Mavs team that went 2 of 17 on triples. So I get it. It's easy to take the superstar and say he wasn't on the floor because he took 2 bad fouls in 26 seconds. I understand. But the Mavericks were never going to win this series, even if everybody played out of their minds, because the Celtics are just better.
What do you think makes the Celtics that good, Arash? Because you look at Tatum and Brown, and I think for a long time the conversation was, are they true superstars in the league? Brown has trouble with his left hand. That was the narrative for a long time. And yet suddenly you inject Drew Holiday into the equation here. And, man, it just seems like the questions we had about Jaylen Brown have been answered. Jason Tatum, I don't even think in this series, has been forced to be the Celtics' best player, but when called upon, he has been that good. And Drew Holiday does all the things that you think are required for sort of the third person in that equation, in that big three, he does all the winning basketball things. So Arash, how are they so good? Because 14 games up on the second-best team in the Eastern Conference of the regular season, they've just carried that the whole way through.
Yeah, just talent, Jesse. They're just flat better. Like,
yeah.
Like, think about Drew Holiday just for a sec. Like, this is the third option on the team. In this series, 26 assists, 0 turnovers.
Yeah, not bad.
Like, think about that for a minute. You know, Jaylen Brown's defense, and look, he's going to get the accolades. I thought the telling moment in Game 3, dying seconds of the third quarter, he sized up Kyrie, and he just saw a little opening, and he went for the kill. And he just attacked the paint, threw 2 Dallas defenders with the dunk. And this is a team that is also fully locked in and fully dialed in. Like, we had a chance to talk to Jason Tatum yesterday, and they didn't do much, you know, with only one day off in between. And the question was, so what did you work on? And everything they talked about was situational basketball. Let's make sure that we're ready for any kind of wrinkle, any kind of scenario that may come our way. And I'm listening to him talk, and I'm like, here's a team from Boston talking situational basketball. I'm like, is there something in New England in the water there? Because that's all Belichick used to preach up the street in Foxborough. And when you talk to the guys on the Celtics, I thought this was really interesting. They talk about losing Game 7 in Miami last year. Not the fact that they were down 3-0, but they talked about losing Game 7. And Jaylen Brown said, that motivated me all summer. That, he said, you have to go through that to end up being great. And the loss to Golden State in 22 in the finals, and then what happened in Miami last year has really propelled them on this journey to getting here.
Arash, have you learned something about Joe Mazzulla while covering these NBA finals here? I mean, this is a guy who has his fair share of critics, non-believers, at the very least, someone who's just caretaking and taking over a team that was always destined for a moment like this. And yet I look at a team that has an answer for everything, is working on every situation as you lay out, and just seems to be without really any adversity. And it feels like, yeah, that's part of the teams that they played and the roster that they built, but also their coach has to get some credit for that. What have you learned about Joe Mazzulla, and does he deserve more credit than he gets?
Yeah, what I've learned about Mazzulla, a few things. One, yeah, overly prepared. That is an over-communicator. Like Jaylen Brown talked about, he said from the beginning of training camp, Mazzulla would just let us know, this is what we're thinking, this is what we want to do. And so he let everybody in on the whole plan, so everybody had a real concept of the vision, the direction, not just night after night in terms of, you know, what the scouting report's going to be, but this is the why. That Mazzulla really allows the players to comprehend the why in the decisions, and that gets buy-in. Here's the other thing, Justin. The guy's also a little crazy. Like, he will show them videos of UFC fighters getting the pulp beat out of them. So, you know, he says that you can't just day in, day out for 180, 200 days just talk ball. He brings a bunch of other things into the equation, too. But he's a heck of a coach. And I thought a very underrated move that the Celtics made this year. They added Jeff Van Gundy as a consultant, as an associate. I think he's going to be an assistant coach next year. Here you bring in a vet who's been through a lot of these in big markets before. I think that's helped them, too.
So you're there. You're on the court. Is there any hope in Dallas that they think that they can do this thing? I mean, it's never been done before. We talked to Luke Gazdick about the Oilers situation, and I mean, it's bleak. We talked a little bit about the leadership in the room in Edmonton. Is there that same sort of feeling with the Dallas Mavericks that they have any chance of coming back in this series, or is it just too much of a mountain to overcome? Is it done tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I have to think it's going to be done. If not tonight, it's going to be done Monday. Maybe yeah. Dallas has something left in them. You know, Jason Kidd was asked before the series, because he played for the Nets when New Jersey at the time went up against Shaq and Kobe and those Lakers. And the question to Kidd was, what did you learn in that series about going up against a team that's Goliath? And he said, well, the difference is talent. And a lot of these Mavericks, outside of Kyrie, none of them had ever been in an NBA Finals before. The Celtics just are too strong, too deep, too locked in. They understand kind of the opportunity here. And it's really interesting, guys, because Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are going to go down in New England lore the same way Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett are. It's funny, you know. The other night, Tom Brady's into the Hall of Fame, and it feels like that region has its next set of stars. And it's two dudes on the Celtics who are going to be locked up for a while. It's not, Jesse, just that I think they're going to win this tonight or Monday. They're going to be a real factor for years to come. And the Celtics and the Nuggets, to me, are the two teams we're going to be seeing a lot of in June's ahead.
Last one for you, Arash. Yeah, the story is Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, the two J's. Is there something within that dynamic between them that had to change for them to get to this point? Or is that all stuff that was noise and not real? Because we've heard about the dynamic before. It looks like Jaylen Brown's going to win NBA Finals MVP, and it feels like that doesn't matter, and maybe that's why they're in this position.
Yeah, they really don't care, and they talk about that. What's really interesting is how far back they go. Like, when you talk about the AAU circuit and a bunch of, like, Under Armour camps when they were teenagers, they actually were teammates and roommates way back when. And Brown, of course, was in the NBA for a year before Tatum got drafted. And he's on vacation. He's in Spain and Malaga or something. When Danny Ainge calls him at, like, 4 in the morning Europe time and Jaylen said he was awake, I can only imagine what he was getting up to in the Costa del Sol at 4 in the morning on vacation in June. And Ainge said, hey, we like Tatum. What do you think? And Jaylen Brown then vouched for him, and they have come up together through summer leagues, through struggles, through understandings, through losing in the finals, to losing Game 7, to now on the court, and both of them, 30-plus points in Game 3, both of them together on this stage in this moment, from the time they were young kids to now at the peak of their profession on the biggest stage in their sport, they're about to propel the franchise to an 18th NBA championship. And as Tatum talked about, he said, if you want to go down as one of the greats to wear this uniform, every other one has a ring.
Yeah.
And they only put up championship banners in Boston. They don't put up banners for Billy Joel. They badly want that 18th because they know their fingerprints are going to be all over it. And the fact that they did it together, it's kind of the icing on the cake.
Yeah, the equal partnership between the two looks pretty good on the Boston Celtics. It's going to look good on those two when that 18th banner does go up to the rafters. Arash, enjoy the game. Enjoy what's left of the series. And we'll catch up with you when you're on your next assignment.
Thanks, guys.
That's Arash Madani, Sportsnet, covering the NBA Finals for Sportsnet in Dallas. Yeah, Malaga. I mean, Madani's going to the Malagas of the world. I don't know if he's up at 4 a.m.
No. He also a staunch defender of Luka Doncic.
Yeah, it's a bit of a zag in terms of what everyone else is saying, of course. And yes, there is a lot of hot takery that goes into this. But when we're talking about, I disagree with him because we're in a championship series. We're talking about your season, your defining moment, perhaps, as an NBA player on the line. Yeah, your defining moment at 25 can be different than it is at 32 when maybe he completely comes of age. But that was a game Dallas could have won. That was a game, again, where Dallas was storming back Boston without an answer for what was happening in that moment, and it all changed the moment Luka picked up what was a bad six foul and had him leave the game. Yeah, he wasn't the one driving the bus, but once he was out of the game, it simplified everything for Boston, who was able to get back in and slow the momentum of everything that was happening. And yeah, I still believe Boston's going to win this series, was going to win the series if they lost that game, probably go up 3-1 tonight, win the 18th banner on the parquet floor at TD Garden. But it was a moment that surely you can't leave without criticism.
Yeah.
Because it was a bad look. It was a bad basketball play. It just wasn't a superstar moment. It was a bad moment for a superstar, and one I'm sure he's going to be thinking about all summer long wherever he decides to go.
I think a lot of it is optics. I really do. I think the fact that he jaws at the officials all game long is something that wears on people who are watching the game, the viewers. You don't want to see that. Like, it was annoying. I remember, obviously when the Raptors won the championship, it's not something you think about so much, but during Kyle Lowry's tenure, like, his propensity to always be talking to the officials, I mean, it gets kind of annoying at a certain point. And now with Luka being on this big of a stage, everybody's watching and everybody now sees what he does game in, game out. And it's always, they're against him. That's the way that he plays on the court. It's like, oh, the refs are against me. I got to talk to them. And even when he got that sixth foul and he looked at the bench and kind of demanded that they challenge when clearly he was going to get called for the sixth foul. Mm-hmm. It's like, there's something about the way that he's, I don't, maybe it's a maturity thing, but the way that he's behaved on the court, I think, has rubbed people the wrong way. Maybe the criticism wouldn't be as stark as it has been had he not approached things this way. And maybe someone needs to just talk to him and say, hey, that's not the way that you should be operating.
Hard to argue, especially with the benefit of knowing what Luka said as he hit the floor, that he wasn't putting himself over the team. Like, he was more worried about, like, I'm out here doing this, you better do this for me. Yeah. when, if you look around, Luka, you're coming back in that basketball game, and it's because everybody else was finally lifting you up, and I think he let them down. The most intrigue, actually, in both these championship series, again, NBA Finals tonight on Sportsnet, Stanley Cup Final Game 4 tomorrow night on Sportsnet, is who's going to win the MVP or the Conn Smythe Trophy in each. We mentioned Jaylen Brown has a lead probably right now on Jason Tatum, especially the odds. The odds do reflect that. I don't know if that one is as interesting. It seems like a toss-up because both of them are actively in pretty good competition for it. I think it's more interesting on the hockey side, though, with the Conn Smythe Trophy, and it really comes down to two, at least for the Florida Panthers, with Alexander Barkov and Sergei Bobrovsky. I think this is the difference between subjective and objective. If you're looking objectively, a .953 save percentage and 4 goals against in 3 Stanley Cup final games, and I know this isn't the entire playoffs, but it's weighted a little bit to the championship series. Like, it's hard to argue with Sergei Bobrovsky. 7 goalies in Stanley Cup final history have finished with a series with a save percentage over 950, so he could become the 8th. Overall, just a .916 with 2 shutouts. But Alexander Barkov would be considered the subjective because he represents everything that makes the Panthers the Panthers. He is the lead dog in that 5-man unit and putting out the example for everyone else to follow. And I guess if you want to give him credit for something, you know, his assignments, the guys that he goes head-to-heads against, the best players on the other teams, well, they've been on milk cartons for the entire playoffs with Alexander Barkov around. So where do you lean, subjective or objective?
Well, I think if you're, you know, a real, true hockey person that likes getting into the weeds on things and tries to look at the defensive assignments that Alexander Barkov has done and when, what he's been able to accomplish, I think you would lean towards Barkov. But I think a goaltender in this situation is a little bit sexier. And that's why I think Bobrovsky is going to win it. And I know the people who are voting are obviously very educated hockey people. But I think when you're on track to finish with the highest save percentage of any goalie in Stanley Cup final history, I think that means something. I think the moment last night when the Oilers were on the verge of tying the game at 4-3, that save that we were talking about, that for me was the moment. Now, you could make the argument that the Barkov 4-1 goal was a moment in and of itself, but I think just watching Bobrovsky do what he did and sort of that was the nail in the coffin of the Oilers in that moment. And for me, that is representative of the Florida Panthers and their run to the Stanley Cup. So I would go Bobrovsky, and being a former goalie myself, I'm maybe a little bit partial to that as well. But man, just watching him play, he's been so unbeatable that it just doesn't seem like it's been a fair fight for anybody going up against him.
Yeah, I don't know if what Sergei Bobrovsky's done has been like totally above what most Stanley Cup winning goaltenders
usually happens
have
that
done.
Way.
Like he's .916 overall. Andrei Vasilevsky won what 3 years ago with a .937. Yeah. Jonathan Quick at .946. It's crazy. Tim Thomas, .940 in 2011. Cam Ward was only a .920 in 2006. But he's had these like signature moments. Like he outdueled Shesterkin.
Yeah.
Although Shesterkin was great. So maybe like statistically, was he that much better? In actuality, was he that much better? I'm not sure, but I know which goaltender advanced.
Yeah.
Same with Jeremy Swayman in the second round, Andrei Vasilevsky in the first round. Like he's had really tough assignments all the way across the path here, going head to head with great goaltenders and coming out on top. But I think I would lean Sasha Barkov.
Yeah.
Because I think if you just watch him every shift, you can kind of get lost. Like unless you're really trying to zone in on him, your focus can go elsewhere. But I don't think I've seen him make a mistake the entire playoffs. Like, he did put a puck over glass last night. I was like, that couldn't have been Barkov, because I've never seen him do something that has hurt or set back the Panthers in any discernible way. For that reason, I just think he's the straw that stirs the drink for this group. And this is a narrative award a lot. It is the identity of the team a lot. And I think Sasha Barkov is the identity of the Florida Panthers. We got about a minute and a half. Let's get to best bets. Where are you leaning after you knitted up a winner with Crochet last?
Yeah, well, what is it? One is luck and two is a trend or something like that. So last night was the Chicago White Sox, who are now 6-28 on the road this season after Garrett Crochet filleted his way through a lineup. I'm going to go with the Philadelphia Phillies tonight, getting plus money once again. So we're going plus money back to back. Ranger Suarez on the hill for the Philadelphia Phillies, and boy, has he been good this season going up against the Baltimore Orioles, who are obviously no slouches, but nonetheless, I like my pitchers, buddy. So give me the Philadelphia Phillies plus 120.
Just betting on good pitchers is generally a decent way to go about things when betting baseball. This is night three of betting the better team at plus money or even money. Mm-hmm. So I'm betting the Boston Celtics. I guess they are technically favored by 1 point minus 110 tonight. But yeah, better team that's going to win the NBA Finals. And I don't have to lay any juice. I will do that with the Boston Celtics.
Yeah.
I got a little greedy last night with that puck line play with the Florida Panthers, though. Could have been 2 for 2. I'll have to settle for 2 for 3 if the Celtics can win tonight. Big championship moments on Sportsnet, potentially. NBA Finals game 4 tonight. Stanley Cup Final game 4 tomorrow night. It's going to be a lot of fun. Jesse, this has been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me in here, buddy. Appreciate it.
I definitely appreciate you coming in here. It's the Fan pregame on a Friday. Enjoy your weekends, everybody.